Risk is the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. This Pride Month, Risk will be featuring the stories of LGBTQ folks from all walks of life. Go get Risk on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Lauren Berry, and welcome to On Deadline, where we take a closer look at stories from Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the country. Let's catch up on the situation in the Middle East, where President Donald Trump announced a ceasefire between Israel and Iran. But there is uncertainty about whether the terms of the agreement are being followed. There's also uncertainty on another front. Trump has claimed that he bombed Iran and destroyed their nuclear capacities, and that both Israel and Iran have agreed to a ceasefire. However, many observers say the facts on the ground do not yet support this. Here we have KCBS political analyst Mark Sandalow discussing what can be proved and what's been alleged.
Risk is the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. This Pride Month, Risk will be featuring the stories of LGBTQ folks from all walks of life. Go get Risk on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
First, Trump announces the U.S. Has bombed Iran and 2 days later announces a ceasefire. Is he the peacemaker?
If he is to be believed, and of course, there's always the if when you're talking about Trump being believed, there's a potential that what the last 72 hours has been a remarkable diplomatic and military success, in that Trump has gone in his words, obliterated Iran's nuclear capacity. And according to Trump, both Israel and Iran have agreed to stop fighting. And there's even talk now of a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. That would be a remarkable accomplishment. The problem is, the facts on the ground don't support it yet. Iran has been very vague as to whether or not there ever was a ceasefire, and Israel was still bombing Iran. And the president was clearly quite upset. I mean, he said they don't know what the expletive begins with an F, by the way, what the F they're doing. And clearly, the ceasefire that he conceived in his mind, that he thought was going to happen, isn't happening yet. But it's still early. It's still early to say. I mean, it's very possible that in the next 24 hours, the violence stops, in which case this will be a dramatic victory for President Trump. On the other hand, we have to assume that things are playing out as he says they are, and that's not always the case.
So what do you think a ceasefire between Israel and Iran actually looks like? Just no bombs?
Presumably no bombs, and essentially I think Iran now knows that any attempt to develop nuclear weapons, or even the risk or the threat or the brag or the rumor of it, is going to bring down serious U.S. military force. And so that's what it would look like. But just to give you a state of our president's state of mind, he's flying right now. He's over the Atlantic in Air Force One on his way to a NATO meeting, where he is set to announce that Europe is going to pay significantly more than they have for NATO, another big accomplishment for Donald Trump and the United States, if true. But here's where his mind is at. He has Truth Social, he does his social media. And he used to be limited when he was on Twitter to what was 180 characters. Well, he just put out a 1,841 character social media thing. And here's what he says, the guy who wants to win the Nobel Prize. Stupid AOC. He goes on and he blasts Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, being one of the dumbest people in Congress. She has a low IQ. He goes on to insult two other women of color in Congress. He talked about how he aced the cognitive test. He goes on to insult Sleepy Joe, Kamala, and the auto pen. It makes you think that, there obviously are other things going on right now in his head. This is one of the things we just have to sit back. I've been watching social media, and, the left is saying, what is wrong with this guy? MAGA people are saying this is the most accomplished day in the Trump presidency. I'm sure the truth lies somewhere in between, and we have no way right now of judging which way it is.
Yeah, that's right. That we'll have to wait and see. But if this does happen, how do Democrats, if there is peace in the Middle East and it's because of the bunker bombs, how do Democrats react and how do they campaign against that?
I think at a certain point, depending on what the long-term results are, you have to tip your hats. I mean, the Democrats would too. you know, I mean, as of yesterday, the most effective movement to stop Iran from building nuclear weapons was President Obama's treaty with Iran. And that slowed down, if not stopped, their production of bombs. Trump pulled out of that treaty. And, you know, this has been the test, saying, no, we need to show force to really stop it. And so now we just see if force is really what stopped it, with what Trump claims are very, very minimal, if not no casualties, except for potentially some nuclear scientists down in the bunker, that'll be considered a great victory. And I'm not exactly sure what Democrats will say. But again, hold on, because there's no reason to believe that the word coming out of the White House these days is any more trustworthy than the word coming out of Tehran, or for that matter, out of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
Thanks, as always, KCBS political analyst Mark Sandolo.
Dr. Usama Khalil, a history professor and chair of the International Relations Department at Syracuse University, has more on the ceasefire that was, and then wasn't, and then was back again.
Well, what is your assessment of the current ceasefire agreement between Israel and Iran?
Well, it looks like it's holding, but I think the more important thing is, after 12 days of this conflict, how much of this was avoidable? And really, much of the fault lies with President Trump in his first term, when he canceled the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was the agreement signed by President Obama with the Iranians over their nuclear program. President Trump campaigned against it and then canceled it and didn't really have anything to take its place. He kept insisting that he was going to get a better deal and did not. Instead, what he did was escalate with the Iranians, including the assassination of Major General Soleimani. And that in part triggered, you know, Iran, which had been in compliance with the agreement, it triggered their enhanced enrichment after he lost the election in 2020. President Biden was supposed to, you know, negotiate a new agreement and did not. And one of the reasons why that didn't go through was President Biden, much like President Trump, kept trying to add different elements to a new agreement. And the Iranians were very suspicious about signing any kind of agreement. Not sure if Biden was going to be able to enforce it, not sure if a new president would come in and scrap it like Trump did. And so we never got a new agreement. And so here we are, 12 days of war. Neither side can claim victory, although both will. President Trump will claim responsibility for a ceasefire. But that's a lot like the arsonist claiming, claiming credit for burning down a house and then helping put the fire out. Right. And that's exactly what's going on here. We are in a much more dangerous place right now, not just in the Middle East, but internationally, because of President Trump's actions. And quite frankly, because of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. What they've done is set this region on fire, and there's no one who's really willing or able to put it out.
Some are claiming victory. I mean, we're talking, many people here are talking about, you know, peace through force, that sort of thing. But how has this recent direct escalation fundamentally changed the nature of the Israel-Iran conflict? Is this a new phase, or is a continuation of a shadow war at a higher intensity?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think what we're seeing is we're going to see a continuation of the shadow war. I think everyone is kind of sitting back and waiting for two things. One, will the Israelis continue attempting to assassinate key Iranian leaders, whether inside Iran or outside of Iran? Now, they keep threatening Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader. They have killed several commanders, but they've been quickly replaced. I mean, this is one of the challenges with this kind of decapitation strategy. The decapitation assassination strategy rarely works. It rarely works with a non-state actor, and it doesn't work with a state actor, right? Iran has a very deep bench. So I think what we're more likely to see is everybody walking on eggshells, waiting for, one, will the assassination campaign continue? And two, where is Iran's enriched uranium? Now, they've said it's been moved. There's about 400 kilograms of it. They've said they have secret sites that nobody knows about. And so I think what we're actually always also waiting to see is Iran going to stay in the non-proliferation treaty? The Iranian parliament has already come out and said, we want to withdraw. And even if we don't withdraw, we want a whole new relationship with the IAEA, which is supposed to monitor these nuclear sites. That, of course, is going to, you know, really set a whole new dynamic in place. President Trump also hasn't helped the situation. You know, there was negotiations with the Iranians, and that seemed to be favorable. In fact, before the war started, there was supposed to be another round in Oman on Sunday, and instead we had the attack by the Israelis on the Iranians. And then President Trump quickly rushed out and said, you know, everything I was doing, all the talks were a deception. All this was to set up these attacks and these assassinations. So when you're using negotiations as a ruse, and that's something, it's not just President Trump, but President Biden did this as well. When you use negotiations as a ruse, it really hurts your credibility. It makes it very difficult for anyone, whether it's the Iranians, the Chinese, or the Russians, to take you seriously going forward. And so what we're really seeing is, I think the shadow war will continue. We'll see, you know, periods of tension and flare-ups. But there's also a bigger issue to America's standing in the world. We can talk about peace through strength, but there needs to be some credibility, right? In fact, what we saw was kind of the United States shooting off missiles at sites that are empty, not destroying them, but claiming they're destroyed. So the United States looks like a paper tiger. It doesn't look like, you know, one that should be feared. We have something like 14 naval vessels in and around the Persian Gulf at the moment, and that includes two aircraft carrier groups and a third on the way. So Americans also have to ask about this expensive force, right? We've been told that we're deeply in debt. We've been told that we can't afford anything, but somehow there's always money for war. And so peace with strength comes with a real cost for the American public at a time when we're seeing, you know, massive cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, threats to Social Security, downsizing of the federal government. And yet we're seeing this massive deployment of force that was completely unnecessary. This was all in a crisis that was created, quite frankly, by the Trump administration and by Israeli President, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. All of it was avoidable. None of it was necessary.
The actions that went down in Iran has been divisive. I mean, but even here in the Bay Area, there are some Bay Area Iranians here that are happy about it. And then there are other people who are, you know, upset that the bombs flew. I'm so glad you're a history professor, because I wanted to ask you about historical grievances and the ideological differences that helped shape this current hostility between Israel and Iran.
Right, sure. So I think one of the things that's often left out is that, you know, this regime, the Iranian government, which came to power after the 1979 revolution, which overthrew the Shah of Iran, who was a close U.S. ally, who himself was installed by a CIA coup. So this is, if you want to talk about history, this takes us back to the 1950s in the Eisenhower administration. So for about 20 plus years, you had a Shah or a king in power who was a close U.S. ally, who was running, you know, a very authoritarian regime, was guilty of all kinds of misdeeds internally and externally, and was overthrown in a popular revolution. But what ended up happening was that, of course, put Iran and the United States at loggerheads. At the same time, I think what's often missed is that Iranian revolutionary government led by Ayatollah Khomeini actually had decent relations with Israel through the 1980s into the 1990s. It started to shift and become much more hostile in the 1990s, you know, paradoxically, as Israel was actually developing better relations with the Arab world and Iran felt left out. You know, some would argue Iran played a bit of a spoiler, but there's still room for both of these countries to exist and exist peacefully. You know, what we haven't talked about here is that, you know, Israel's actions, including the ongoing occupation, the genocide in Gaza, all of these that are ongoing with U.S. support, that in itself really kind of cuts to the chase of this idea of these kind of ideological differences. All of this can be settled through negotiations and diplomacy. The United States has chosen not to, and Israel has chosen not to. In fact, what we've seen is there may be a ceasefire between Israel and Iran, but Israel continues to bomb southern Lebanon. It continues to occupy a huge chunk of Syria. And of course, you have the ongoing occupation of the Palestinian territories, the West Bank and Gaza, and an ongoing genocide that the United States is unwilling and unwilling to stop.
But also an ongoing support of Iranian proxies like Hamas and the Houthis.
Right. So one of the things you're seeing is this. So you do have a support of proxies that has been diminished somewhat, right? At the same time, it's also we've seen a kind of a failure of that strategy, right? So this was supposed to be some kind of a deterrence mechanism by the Iranians, and it hasn't really deterred anything. You know, we have decent evidence, for example, after the October 7th attacks that Iran did not want, for example, Hezbollah to participate in any kind of retaliation. Iran had not been involved in the prior planning of the October 7th attacks. And as you can see, the ceasefire came in without a comparable ceasefire for Gaza. So, you know, the influence that Iran may or may not have on Hamas is really up for speculation, right? The reality is there's a lot of local factors that go on with proxy groups. They make their own decisions. They're not following dictates, much like we would not see, you know, we would not talk about other groups in that way. I think the other factor that you want to consider is that there's also Israel and the United States are backing proxies against Iran, right? So there are several groups, including those that have been that are labeled as terrorist organizations, the Mujahideen al-Khalq, for example, who are actively setting off, you know, bombs inside Iran and part of the assassination campaign. That rarely gets any coverage. So I think, you know, it's disappointing to hear that you have, you know, anybody cheering bombing, right? And the deaths of civilians. We've had several hundred civilians who've been killed inside Iran as part of the Israeli attacks. We've had civilians inside Israel that have been killed as part of the missile attacks back. And at the same time, in Gaza, you've had almost 100 people killed almost every day for the past several weeks as part of these death traps around the humanitarian corridor that's been set up. To call it a humanitarian corridor, quite frankly, is a misnomer. These are death traps, and they're using humanitarian aid as a cover for that. And I think this is one of the things that has to get us back to is what is the U.S.'s goal and strategy in the region? What are our goals internationally? What does the Trump administration want to achieve? And part of that we have to think about is how do we start to dial down the temperature here? How do we start to get people back to the negotiating table? How do we end the genocide in Gaza? How do we, one, control the Iranian nuclear program? One of the things that's going to come out of this, I fear, is that Iran is going to be much less willing to cooperate on any kind of negotiations going forward about its nuclear program. What they will say and what the hardliners will say is the following. We were negotiating, we were cooperating, and you betrayed us. You know, you deceived us and you betrayed us. And so now we're done cooperating and we're done negotiating. We're going to do what we have a right to do, what any other country has a right to do. And that's dangerous for everybody. It's not just if Iran does it. But imagine the message you're sending to the rest of the world. What's the message you're sending to Russia and China or North Korea? What's the message you're sending to Brazil or Indonesia? If the only thing that's going to keep your government safe from attack by any external power is a nuclear weapon, that's the message that's been sent by what's gone on here the past 12 days.
I don't know if deterrence works. Maybe not. The government has said that the purpose of it was to, you know, keep the nukes out of Iranians' hands. They're saying that it was a targeted, a one-off thing. This was not against the Iranian people. This was not against the Iranian troops. But yet there's talk of regime change. So how does regime change figure into all of this?
Well, this is the real danger. And so I think one of the questions that every American has to ask, all your listeners have to ask is, you know, we've had 20 plus years of regime change operations across the Middle East, right? So in Afghanistan, the United States spent 20 plus years deposing the Taliban, only to then cut a peace treaty with the Taliban. The United States overthrew Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and then we still have U.S. troops based in Iraq 20 plus years later. We had a successful regime change operation in Libya. But then you had chaos in Libya that's still ongoing. Libya has been partitioned and it's still not a whole state again. Syria underwent a 14-year regime change war that was finally successful, and it's quite frankly also partitioned into two or three parts with U.S. troops still in Syria. Iran would be a much more difficult case. It would be a much more problematic case, and it's scary to hear the same playbook being offered. The same people we're talking about, peace through strength, are talking about a very easy regime change. There is no easy regime change. What you can do is regime collapse. But regime collapse means a civil war. It means thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of deaths. It means large-scale displaced persons, refugees, a deep destabilized country of some 90-plus million people in the heart of the Persian Gulf that has a spillover effect into Central Asia, into the rest of the Middle East, and into South Asia. This is a recipe for a disaster. And one of the questions is, you know, when we talk about regime change, is this what kind of model are you going to adopt? So in Iraq, the United States inserted troops into a disastrous war and occupation that we're still living with, and the consequences of it we're still living with. In Syria and in Libya, the United States relied on proxy forces. Now, it may do that again, right? And that, of course, has a huge, tremendous impact, not just for the region, but for all of us. You know, one of the things that we've avoided, we've sidestepped with this 12-day war, was the constant threat to oil and natural gas supplies. So, for example, 30%, if not more, of the natural gas that feeds the rest of the world and keeps our homes heated, cars, etc., comes out of the Persian Gulf, right? and it's at least 30%. So you can imagine if that is taken offline, there's not enough out there of sustainable supplies to make up for that 30 to 40, if not higher percentage. The vast majority of oil that feeds not so much the U.S., but the rest of the world comes out of the Persian Gulf. So if those traffic lanes are closed, this is what's known as the Straits of Hormuz, if that's closed, the global impact of that, the impact of the global economy could be catastrophic. Now, you can imagine what would happen if you have rival forces going at it in a regime change or regime collapse conflict in Iran, what the consequences of that could be to the flow of oil tankers, et cetera, in and through the Persian Gulf. And then, of course, there's a human toll. So those who are celebrating the dropping of bombs today should think about what the human toll is. Who's on the receiving end of those bombs? What is the anger? What kind of detriment does it do to that population, and what carries forward? Who takes over afterward? It won't be clean. It won't be easy. It never is. This is a fantasy that Americans have been sold for 20 to 30, 40 years. We were sold it in Vietnam, and we're being sold it again here. We were sold it in Iraq, and it was a false promise. Over and over again, we've been told that there'll be quick and easy wars, and none of them have been quick and easy. And they've all had consequences for us at home, as well as for folks, for the people living abroad. We rarely see it. We rarely talk about those people who are on the receiving end of our bombs or the money we spend on covert ops. But those people have lives, and they have dreams, and they have children, and they have hopes. And that's one of the things that we need to take a step back and think about. What are the consequences of these foreign policies? What are the consequences of these actions and things we throw around terms like regime change or regime collapse, like we're talking about, ordering a meal? This has direct consequences for everyone involved, and it is not quick and it's not easy. It never is.
Just briefly, though, the people in charge in Iran right now, not very popular. There could be an uprising, right?
Well, not popular with who, right? I mean, so one of the things that this war has actually done, even if you were opposed to the government, right, you're rarely going to go and side up with people who were bombing you and are bombing indiscriminately. So keep in mind, the Israelis would claim that they were bombing bombing the military or nuclear sites. That was not true. We know that they were bombing all kinds of civilian locations, including taking out power plants, taking out all kinds of hospitals, etc. So you're rarely going to side with those people that are bombing you and claim that they're there to liberate you. That's not the way this works. So however popular or unpopular they were, they're far more popular than the people who are bombing them. Right? This is a fantasy that we're being sold. We rarely talk to Iranians on the street. We've been sold this message that somehow that government's unpopular, but our government is extremely popular, right? Our government is loved and theirs is hated. We know that's not the case. Right? You can look at President Trump's approval ratings. You can see how they're fluctuating based on his policies. And so let's not pretend like, for example, that government is hated, but our government is loved around the world. It's not the case. I think we also want to think about people want stability. They want their lives, right? So they may not even be thinking about politics on a day-to-day basis in the way that we think. They want to go about their lives. They want their jobs. They want their kids to go to school. They want their kids to eventually get their own lives and have their own families. That doesn't happen when you have a regime change, regime collapse, war. That doesn't happen. Everybody's life gets upended. Nobody wants to be a refugee. Nobody wants to be a displaced person.
At the center of the situation with Iran and Israel is the president and the choices that he's making, which are riling up some people even in his own party. You see, President Trump was against intervening in other countries' affairs. That's until he wasn't. And that change has his MAGA base, at least some of them, roiling. So how far can the president go before reaching a tipping point with his own supporters? Let's hear more on this from David Schultz. He's a professor of political science at Hamline University, speaking live on the Tommy Tucker Show at WWL in New Orleans.
Hey, this year, reading from a story here, Fox News poll found that 38% of registered voters support the One Big Beautiful Bill. And when I see 38%, I got to tell you, it goes to that's the magic number when it comes to Trump's support of his base, where it's 38%. Again, think that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't matter. Am I wrong? And am I making a false connection there or not?
No, I think you're pretty close in terms of it, in terms of he's got a core base of support that's with him no matter what, whether it's the Big Beautiful Bill or you know, what just happened, you know, the bombing in Iran, whatever it may be, they are core with him. But what becomes interesting also, and again, there's different polls that have looked at different things, of course, or slightly different things. If you actually start to break it down now into terms of saying, you know, what do people like or dislike about it? You know, once you start to say things like, well, do you support the idea that, you know, that this bill may, you know, raise, you know, cut taxes for, you know, for billionaires or cut insurance, you know, for you or something like that, then it becomes a little bit more interesting in terms of where it plays out for Trump supporters. But just the generic, do you support this bill? Yep, support it. I'm with him no matter what. I trust him no matter what.
But that's what I think the disconnect is in that 38%, because they do trust President Trump no matter what. However, when you ask them, how do you feel about debt and deficit? How do you feel about this? How do you feel about that? They're conflicted because they don't necessarily trust him when it comes to that, but they do trust him, so it's cognitive dissonance, so let's just support the president, pretty much. Am I wrong there?
I think it is at this point. I gave a talk recently. There was somebody who, you know, some reporter asked two of us, once, both political scientists, and they say, you know, why the loyalty to Trump? And this other person said, oh, it's polarization. I said, no, it's not polarization. I said, it's really a cult of personality mm-hmm. that he's really has at this point, is that it's just about him in terms of this attraction he has. And by the way, I'm not saying good or for bad.
No, and look, I'm getting ready to say that right now. There's not saying it's good, not saying it's bad. I'm just asking for historical context when it comes to cult of personality. Have we seen this before in this country? Or not?
Yeah, I think we have at some point. I think over time we've had people so devoted to who the president of the United States is, whether it's Ronald Reagan. I'm going to say it a decent past. For a while, you might have had it with people such as Franklin Roosevelt. You know that people were just very, very devoted, you know, to that person and just absolutely loved that person. Now it's hard to figure out at this point. If you look at 250 years, is there more of a personal devotion? Uncritical devotion to Trump and previous presidents, hard to measure, or hard to tell, because 250 years of a lot of history. We don't have polling that goes back. But I would suggest, though, that this is a pretty strong cult of personality, because Trump himself, I mean, he called it right on the head a decade ago, you know, with the Fifth Avenue shooting argument or line at this point. So he knows that he's got this very devoted group of people, and you give him credit for it. You know, he knows how to work with that base to be able to move things.
And of course, no matter what you say, somebody texted in and said, Tommy has pictures of Trump on his nightstand, hashtag obsessed. Whoever texted us in, I could list about 35 things that I have on my list that take precedent over Donald Trump in terms of me caring about at least 30 things. So believe what you want, but I'm just trying to cover what's going on here. Let's talk about the big, beautiful bill, because what I find interesting about this is that the president has got about a year left till the midterms, right? We'll talk about this when we come back. Time till the midterms and what kind of stranglehold he's got, not necessarily a bad thing, what kind of strength he's got over Republican leaders and opposition as far as this big, beautiful bill, because it seems as though if a certain amount of Republicans, I'm just talking about the politics here, y'all, take a breath, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but in terms of the politics of it, I think if some Republicans are willing to stand up to him, then it might, in a way, be an emperor is not wearing any clothes kind of thing, where all of a sudden it's okay, you got your 38%, but that's all you got. And then let's see what happens from here, or maybe not. Just looking at the politics of this, and it seems as though if Republicans can muster in the Senate the strength to stand against Trump on this, this could be an emperor's new clothes kind of moment where, okay, then maybe Republicans can chart their own way for the party and don't have to fall into the cult of Donald Trump. But maybe I'm reading too much into this. What do you think?
Well, this is going to be interesting, because we know we have the midterm elections next year. And for both House and Senate members, there are a certain percentage of them who are vulnerable. You know, if you look at their districts, you know, if they were to vote for the big, beautiful bill, and several senators, like what Josh Hawley has pointed this out, like if they were to make significant cuts, you know, to Medicaid, for example, this is going to hurt their constituents. And we know this across the country also. And a lot of the Republican senators are looking at it saying that, listen, for two reasons. One, I don't want to hurt my constituents. You know, my job is to help my constituents, not to hurt them. And B, if I hurt my constituents, this may endanger both my reelection or Republican control, you know, of the House and or Senate. And so it's an interesting poll at this point, is that do you remain loyal to your party's president, or do you now say, gosh, I need to act in the best interest or of my constituents? And that's what's going to be really fascinating to look at here also, too, is this dual poll. And, you know, dual poll, you know, between, you know, what a lot of these representatives and senators are going to do. And it really will tell us something about the future of the party in terms of where it's headed, because at some point there will be a Republican Party beyond Donald Trump. And I think the Republicans need to figure out what that party is going to look like and what it's going to stand for.
So could you make a case, I'm trying to think what the Congressional Budget Office has said about this bill, that President Trump is saying, you know what, I'm concerned about the future of the nation, not the states and debt and deficit. And the GOP senators are saying, I'm concerned about getting reelected or about my people, therefore I don't want to cut Medicaid. Or, are both disingenuous because it's still contributing to debt and deficit?
Well, I'll go to your last statement first. If we look at, I think the most interesting warning sign that came out in the last few weeks is when Moody's basically said, we're downgrading the bond rating of the United States because of the spending that we have. And if the Big Beautiful Bill passes, I mean, this is going to have huge implications in terms of the debt load for the United States. And so think about this on the one level. We've got lots of Republicans and lots of us just in general who are concerned about the scope of our national debt, who are concerned about our deficit every year. And across the board, everybody recognizes the fact that the Big Beautiful Bill is going to have huge implications in terms of increasing our national debt, which I don't think, I'll defer to economists. Economists are saying that's not good for the country in terms of it. So where do we go? Do we go in terms of, if I'm a Republican senator, for loyalty to the president, or do I say that my first loyalty is to the good of the nation, and this bill does not further the good of the nation in terms of the debt load and the deficit?
So the Republicans that oppose it are saying you're hurting my constituents and not really doing anything to address debt and deficit. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's exactly what we're hearing from some of them at this point. And the question now becomes, do they say at this point that those are more important concerns than supporting the president of the United States? And keep in mind, our founding fathers, you know, the Ben Franklins et al. Of the world presuppose that our system operates when members of Congress do their job. That's the whole concept of separation of powers and checks and balances. And their argument was country is supposed to come first, not loyalty to the president. In fact, your job is to check the president of the United States.
Along those lines, I just want to ask you real quick, the legal mandate, whatever is needed for the president to bomb Iran, can he do that as commander-in-chief, or does he need somebody's approval for that?
He should have had permission from Congress to do that. Either the Constitution does not allow him to do this kind of preemptive attack, and the War Powers Act doesn't allow him to do that. He needed to get permission.
With the fighting between Israel and Iran, and the United States' sudden intervention in it, other highlights of Trump's agenda have taken a backseat. But this week, something in the Bay Area got our attention. Take a listen to political insider Flo Matier.
Risk is the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. A podcast all about human connection and radical honesty. All through June for Pride Month, Risk will be featuring the stories of LGBTQ folks from all walks of life. You'll laugh, cry, and maybe even end up feeling a little bit better. Go get Risk on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Phil, I want to share this headline from the San Francisco Standard. The Golden Gate Bridge is dangerously woke, the CEO warns. What is going on?
What we have here is a new president, and along with the new president was an executive order that basically said transportation funding is going to be predicated going forward on, you know, the question of what you have in your language, in your contracts, in your resolutions, and in your policies. They want the DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and references to racial discrimination or social justice. They want that scrubbed from the policies and of the trans transit agencies across the country. We're seeing this in funding on a number of issues. And Dennis Mulligan, who is the director of the Golden Gate Bridge, is looking at a $400 million grant from the feds, which the bridge has got in order to retrofit the bridge. And he says basically there's three options. I spoke with him this morning. The first one is, you know, to try to just ignore the order and hope for the best. But he says that's impossible. This is the Golden Gate Bridge, and it's in California, Margie. It's in San Francisco. This would be a target for the Trump administration. They would go after it. The second thing is you can say, we're going to sue the federals. We're going to sue, say that this is unconstitutional, but then we're betting on the current Supreme Court agreeing with you. That's after a couple of years of litigation when they need the money now to start retrofitting the bridge. The third one is to say, hey, we're standing on this principle. We're not going to do it. You can keep your money. The problem is, there is no money from the state or the locals in order to make for the retrofit of the Bay Bridge. So it's a question of priorities, and he's going to put it to the 19-member board of directors that represent everything from San Francisco up to the Oregon border for them to figure if they want to go which way.
So you really have to thread the needle here because you need that money. That's a lot of money, $400 million.
It's a lot of money. Other California transit districts, whether they be BART, Muni, or others, they're facing a financial cliff. The Golden Gate Bridge is holding its own, but it needs, if it says no to that money, that means years and years of tolls that would otherwise go into ferry service and bus service is going to have to go into the bridge. It's not a pretty picture. Now, the question is, are you just removing the language or are you changing the policies? And I think this is a case of where you're removing the language, not necessarily changing how the board or the district is going to run. The question is, politically, do you fight the Trump administration or do you bend a knee to it? And that is something that directors, many of them are politicians, you know, members of board of supervisors from various counties and such, are going to have to decide.
Well, regardless, the drag queens will continue to sing Open Up Your Golden Gates, California. Here I come, right?
You've got the closing line of the day.
I'm Lauren Berry, and I want to say thank you for listening to On Deadline. This show is produced by me and by Christy Strouser. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Risk is the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. This Pride Month, Risk will be featuring the stories of LGBTQ folks from all walks of life. Go get Risk on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.